Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
Today's program was brought to you by Patina Events at Brooklyn Botanic Garden, an idyllic location for weddings, corporate events, and parties of any style. Visit us at patinaevents.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we're getting semantic to understand the deeper meaning behind some of the foods we love. First, we'll look at the big debate happening around the word milk.
Who the hell are you to tell me what is the name of my product and my landscape and everything we've cared about when, you know, you don't have anything invested in except to put out a little money to buy it? It's our entire life.
Then we get the lowdown on the language of cider.
So the first thing that's really confusing about dryness is that it has nothing to do with how something actually feels in your mouth.
And finally, we get our fill of tiki talk.
You don't walk into a tiki bar and be like, oh yeah, this is what Polynesia is probably like. Like, it's supposed to be like fantasy and stuff. That's the hard part. It's so easy to do tiki bad, and that's where it gets a bad name.
Tune into this week's episode of Meat and Three. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. And we are going to speak today with Art Cullen, the editor of the Storm Lake Times, a twice-a-week county seat newspaper in northwest Iowa. Mr. Cullen won the 2017 Pulitzer Prize for editorial writing for a series on agricultural pollution of surface water. He is the author of the book Storm Lake, a chronicle of change, resilience, and hope from a Heartland newspaper published by Viking in 2018. And he works with his brother John, who is founder and publisher of the Times, his wife Dolores, a feature writer and photographer, and son Tom, a reporter, keeping it all in the family. I like that, Art. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Well, thanks for having me, Katie.
It's a real pleasure. Your reputation precedes you, I must say. I've read quite a few very complimentary things about you and heard complimentary things about you from other reporters. So I'm excited that you decided to agree to be on the show today. So we're going to talk about the Heartland Forum that took place in the beginning of April. But before we start talking about those Democratic candidates, first I want you to describe Storm Lake, Iowa, and who is your paper reaching out to? Who are your readers?
Storm Lake is a town of 10,000 to 15,000 people in northwest Iowa, and this is corn, soybean, and hog country, and we have two large meat processing plants in Storm Lake owned by Tyson that processes turkey and pork. And so as a result, we have a majority immigrant community in Storm Lake now.
Oh, interesting.
90% of our elementary school are children of color. Mainly from Latin America, and it also happens to be in the center of congressional district, the 4th congressional district of Iowa, which is home to Congressman Steve King, who is probably the leading immigrant basher in Washington other than Donald Trump.
Yes. Well, or Stephen Miller. Yeah, absolutely. But, you know,
right.
Definitely high on the high on the list of liberal let's put it this way. We're, us liberals, be putting our pins in his voodoo doll on a regular basis. Not a fan.
So this is Storm Lake is a little dot of blue in a sea of Farm Bureau red here in northwest Iowa, and it's probably the richest corn ground in the world. And so that's kind of where we lay.
So the people of the Latin American immigrants, you don't have a big Somali population there. That surprises me because I thought they were really manning those poultry and hog plants. It's mostly Latin Americans who are coming up to your community.
Well, there's about 30 languages or dialects spoken in Storm Lake, and no doubt there's Somalis here. But because it's a pork plant, there aren't a lot of Muslims working there. And they tend to work more in poultry. And so there's a lot of Southeast Asians, people from Myanmar, Samoa, but about 75% are from Latin America.
And that would be those the folks that are coming up from like Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, the same sort of northern triangle of Central America?
No, primarily they started from the state of Jalisco, an agricultural state whose capital is Guadalajara. They were young men driven north by the North American Free Trade Agreement as we flooded Mexico with corn. Number two, yellow corn from Iowa. We put the campesinos out of business in Chiapas and Jalisco. And so they moved north to work in our meatpacking plants. And so now Tyson ships pork down to Japan or to Mexico for further processing, where it's shipped on to Japan. It's an interesting global phenomenon. The Latinos originally Southeast Asians came to Storm Lake from Laos. It was the Thai Dom culture. We brought the Thai Dom culture in its entirety from Thailand refugee camps to primarily Storm Lake, Iowa, and Des Moines. And that started in the late 1970s. So now we have a Buddhist temple in Storm Lake. It's a gorgeous gold leaf temple next to a ready mix concrete plant. So it's a very interesting little cosmopolitan rural community.
Yeah. Now, why do you think, given that Steve King is your congressional representative, why does he keep getting reelected? I know we're going off track immediately. I warned you this would happen. You're just obviously way too interesting. But why does he keep getting reelected? Aren't these people voting against him?
Well, yeah, Storm Lake proper votes against Steve King and against Donald Trump. But the rest of Northwest Iowa is very heavily Republican and conservative. Abortion is a very big issue here. Steve King, despite all his remarks that are perceived as racist, it's not really fear or hatred of immigrants that's driving the vote. It's people wanting to flip the bird to New York, Washington, and California. That's really what it's about.
That's so sad.
It's kind of the Midwestern phenomenon of the feeling resentful and flown over. And, you know, the manufacturing jobs have all left for Mexico, yet Mexicans are coming to Iowa and Wisconsin. And it tends to make people resentful, and they vote for, these xenophobic candidates.
Mm-hmm. But then there's also the aspect that unions, you know, basically got busted down to nothing under the during the Reagan era, right? So the Americans didn't really want those meatpacking jobs anymore, right?
No, that's right. I mean, in 1980, the high-grade meatpacking plant here closed down. It was reopened by IBP at half the wages as a non-union plant. So if those union workers, what they were getting paid in 1975, they'd be making $125,000 a year today.
Right.
But instead, the meat packers today are making about $18 an hour, which is, isn't bad money in a town like Storm Lake where rent is $500 a month.
Right. It's not terrible, but it's certainly not a middle class.
It's the first step on the rung to the ladder to success. And the kids of these immigrants are going to Buena Vista University or local college and are graduating with, teaching degrees, science degrees. The beautiful thing is they're staying here. And so you can see the American story building here.
Oh, wow. That's fabulous. It's a wonderful story you're telling there. So let's talk about the panel that you moderated. That was at the Heartland Forum, I think it was called. Am I getting that right?
Right.
And there were about 6 or 7 presidential hopefuls who showed up for that.
We had 5. We had Elizabeth Warren, Julian Castro, John Delaney, Tim Ryan, and Amy Klobuchar.
Oh, right.
And so it was a pretty good mix of people, really, from populist to kind of moderate business lanes.
So what did you ask them?
Well, the first thing I asked, actually it was Senator Warren, was what can be done now urgently to save the Midwest in particular from a farm income crisis? There's suicide rates, especially among Wisconsin dairy farmers, are at their highest level since the mid-1980s farm crisis. And so that's really the urgent question that's on the mind of Midwestern agriculture right now, is how are we going to get through this trade war that's depressed corn and soybean markets, and how are we going to get a crop in this spring? And and the answer was, we don't control Washington or the USDA, the Republicans do, and therefore we've got a lot of answers for you in 2020. Well, that ain't soon enough.
Well, I know that one of Elizabeth Warren's hobby horses is the breaking up of mega agribusinesses.
Yeah.
Was that seen as a positive reform that your community would be interested in pursuing? Do they want that?
The one thing that ultra-conservative Chuck Grassley and ultra-progressive Tom Harkin could agree on was antitrust and breaking up big meat packers and big chemical companies and seed companies.
Right.
So I think Elizabeth Warren is on to something. And,
yes.
But that doesn't fix our immediate problem, which is, we've been talking about breaking up the trust since Teddy Roosevelt, and we're still talking about it. And so that doesn't solve our immediate problem of this. We do have this highly contracted ag supply chain that keeps just wringing itself for efficiency and keeps wringing out farmers out the bottom. And how do we ease the pain as we transition to some sort of new arrangement?
Right. And I mean, what kind of legislation or legislative battles do you face in order to make those new arrangements? I know she mentioned something about unwinding the Bayer-Monsanto merger. It's a done deal. Like, I don't know how you can suddenly turn around and say, oh, sorry, oops, the regulations have decided that you're not allowed to do that. I didn't hear a plan for that. I'm wondering if you
exactly. did. Or if you break up, for example, Tyson and you say they're going to finish hogs here and slaughter them there. And what about the 3,000 families who are working here trying to build a future? Do they get hit by flying debris as we blow everything up? So and I don't think Elizabeth Warren or Amy Klobuchar, either one of them, are that reckless. But right now they're at the phase of ginning up the base, and that's a very popular line with conservative and liberal rural people, is nobody is in love with Monsanto or Dow DuPont.
Right, absolutely. And then there was actually, I interviewed Leah Douglas last week, who I know you know from Food and Environment Reporting Network, just to get her take on it. And one of the things she said that was most popular in that discussion was, in the antitrust part of the discussion, was the idea of the right to fix your own equipment, like not having to go to John Deere to get your parts. And have them do the fixing. If you can fix it yourself, you should be able to fix it yourself. And that apparently is a big issue for farmers, among many other things. I thought that was an interesting little wrinkle that I wasn't aware of before. What other kinds of things like that were there? Were there other issues of that ilk, sort of, that are kind of granular in that way that the average American probably would not be aware of, but which has a big impact on the farming community?
Yes, I think there was one, and nobody picked up on it. I offered several openings, and that is, we have to figure out a way in an era of climate change and soil degradation it's reaching crisis proportion, soil erosion because of mm-hmm. because of more extreme weather. We're seeing it right now in flooding in southwest Iowa that's just scoured thousands upon thousands of acres into sand.
Ooh.
And we have to figure out the Gulf of Mexico is dying because of erosion and because of over-fertilizing Illinois and right. Iowa cropland. And so we need to figure out a new paradigm for agriculture that can be more flexible with climate change and can regenerate our soil health. And we can do it through a little-known program in the Farm Bill called the Conservation Stewardship Program that was actually authored by Senator Harkin. And it rewards farmers for using conservation and soil-building techniques on working lands.
Right.
And that is returning us to a rotational grazing system that involves cattle on the landscape mm-hmm. rather than in unsustainable feedlots,
mm-hmm.
and puts Iowa back into grass and holds our soil in place so we can continue to grow corn, but then put grass at the margins and prevent the
right.
pollution. But nobody understands the program outside of Iowa.
Huh. That's interesting. I mean, I am quite well aware of the Conservation Stewardship Program. I'm also aware that in the most recent, and I haven't read the most recent Farm Bill, but one of the things that I have heard is being considered is removing funding for the Conservation Stewardship Program. Was that discussed at all?
Amy Klobuchar said we need to protect a strong conservation title in the Farm Bill, and that was the only. And Tim Ryan from Ohio actually understands it pretty well. The
yes.
others gave it lip service, and they don't realize that this is the future of agriculture. That the farming in a chemical base is not sustainable,
right.
and there's plenty of research from respected sources, from NASA to the University of Minnesota to Iowa State University, is telling us that our corn yields could decline in half over the next 30 to 50 years if we don't change our ways.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I've interviewed Chris Jones quite a bit, a couple of times from Iowa State
brilliant.
University. I'm sure you know him. He's been very much in the forefront of sort of like, you know, blowing the whistle or waving the red flag saying, you know, this just is not going to work, guys. You gotta figure something else out.
Yeah, he knows the score.
Do you think that that this, you know, like this, have you had groups of Democratic hopefuls come through in the past talking about these issues that are near and dear to the Iowa, you know, heart? Or is this like a new phenomenon to have people pay attention to this? I feel like agriculture is always kind of the last thing that people ever talk about when it comes to campaigning.
Yeah, well, Jimmy Carter did, and that's why he won the Iowa caucuses. And John Kerry mm-hmm. paid some attention to it. But otherwise, no. Bill Clinton may have, but he bypassed Iowa because Tom Harkin was running for president. So there has been no discussion, and the farm legislation has drifted toward a free market approach that creates a vacuum because there's never really a free market in agriculture and food production. There never can be since the times of the Egyptians building granaries. So, you know, people rush in to fill that vacuum, and that's corporate consolidation. And so we see what we're seeing right now with the farm income crisis, polluted surface water, and, you know, increasing suicide rates because we've taken a laissez-faire approach to agriculture in our government policy.
Yes. Yes, and that how many decades does that go back? Would you ascribe? I love to put everything at the feet of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah, exactly. It's called Freedom to Farm. John Block was the Secretary of Agriculture under Ronald Reagan, and of course it really goes back to Earl Butz when he said
yes.
Nixon's press or agriculture secretary said we need to farm fence row to fence row to feed the world. And we're still operating under the misimpression that we're feeding the world by growing number two yellow corn. What we're really doing is feeding hogs, and there's still plenty of people in Africa starving to death.
Sure, absolutely. We're feeding hogs and we're feeding the ethanol industry, and that's about it.
Exactly.
So how did people respond to what the Democrats were saying? Were they enthusiastic? Did you feel like that they might vote Democratic in the next election? Or do you think it was just kind of like, oh yeah, you know, here they are again. They've got their talking points, but nothing's ever gonna change. What was the response?
Well, I have to say that most of the crowd was members of the Farmers Union, which is a progressive farm group. And so I'd have to say that they were all pretty enthusiastic about all the candidates. And surprisingly, I think they were very enthusiastic about John Delaney, because he actually got, you know, he did get granular on, like, Medicaid, which is a very hot issue in Iowa right now. Uh-huh. And also, since the forum, about a week later, Beto O'Rourke showed up. And he spoke to a packed house here in Storm Lake at a cafe, over 100 people there. And he showed a pretty impressive command of agriculture, climate change, and Midwestern issues. And everybody, you know, a lot of people think he doesn't have that gravitas. And I think he really showed he did. And so candidates really are reaching out. They're learning about rural issues. And they're saying the right things.
Yeah, that's nice to hear. I hope that, it, you know, if we prevail, I do hope to see some changes. But I can't say that I'm hugely optimistic. So would you say that John Delaney or Beto O'Rourke was actually the best of the lot in terms of really identifying and drilling down on some of those issues and being able to speak very directly to the major concerns of Iowa farmers? Or was like the antitrust, you know, the Elizabeth Warren message more compelling?
Well, I think the antitrust message received more play, but I think there was a lot of people who were listening very carefully, and, you know, they're almost professional at it in Iowa.
Yeah.
Joe Biden's been campaigning here since 1988. So, you know, we're used to, and they're very careful listeners, and they understand what the Trans-Pacific Partnership is all about. And that's one thing that Delaney immediately declared, is the first thing I'd do is sign up for the TPP, and yeah, that's the quickest way to restore markets. And that might not be the answer for the Farmers Union people. Who were in the audience, they may have different ideas. But I think there was a lot of people who were saying, you know, here's a guy who does understand markets, how markets work. And I think they were also saying, you know, Elizabeth Warren is brilliant, and she's a Harvard Law professor, and she really does understand what the structural problem in markets and in production are. And so I think a wide spectrum of views is out there, and it's wider than people think. It's not all just antitrust. And if you talk with O'Rourke, you know, he takes a fairly nuanced view of things, and it's very hard to, he's not very dogmatic, similar to Bill Clinton and or Obama, really. Mm-hmm. And so those are all interesting candidates to me.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it's thrilling to see, it's especially thrilling to see younger people, you know, coming into the race. That to me is like very exciting. I'm so sick of these old white guys. I just can't even, you know, present company excluded, of course.
Yeah, now that, you know, and Joe Biden's going to be, like I say, he's been running since 88, and he's going to be coming into the room pretty soon and sucking all the oxygen out. So it's going to be real interesting to see what happens to some of these other candidates.
Absolutely. We're going to take a quick break for a sponsor drop, and I mean very quick, and then we'll be right back with Art Cullen from the Storm Lake Times in Storm Lake, Iowa. Stay tuned, folks. We're going to talk more about presidential politics. We'll be right back.
Patina Restaurant Group offers unparalleled service in New York's most iconic locations, including Lincoln Center, Rockefeller Center, and Macy's Herald Square. Patina is also the exclusive caterer at Brooklyn Botanic Garden. From meetings and presentations in the glass-walled atrium, to galas in the renovated Palm House, and intimate wedding showers at Yellow Magnolia Cafe, your event will be perfectly imagined and customized at Brooklyn Botanic Garden. You can also enjoy a la carte brunch and lunch at the picturesque Yellow Magnolia Cafe overlooking Lilypool Terrace. Executive Chef Morgan Jarrett's unique menu offers warm, distinctive cuisine with a focus on local vegetables, grains, and sustainably sourced meats and fish.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Jimmy Carboni, and I'm the host of Beer Sessions Radio here on HRN. My show is an audio ale salon celebrating the world of craft beer, cider, food, and more. Through discussions with industry insiders and knowledgeable beer fans, my friends and I explore every aspect of the brewer's craft, from grains to pint glass and tasting to toasting. You can find Beer Sessions Radio wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Okay, we're back. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. We're talking to Art Cullen from the Storm Lake Times. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, and he was hosting and moderating a panel of Democratic hopefuls at the beginning of the month of April. And so we're, you know, we're just talking policy. So, Art, what do you think about Republican leadership? Like, do you think that you might have a similar opportunity with Republican leaders coming to Iowa? Say, for example, Donald Trump took a swing through Iowa. What would you ask him about?
Well, I don't think that Donald Trump is going to allow me the opportunity to ask him anything. frankly.
I know, but in a perfect world, if you could ask him what his farm...
Well, when are you going to end this damn trade war, you know? That's what I would ask him. And, there's a lot of, you know, Sherrod Brown, for example, who would disagree with me. But I think of an old farmer friend of mine who said that, you know, the way you build rapport with people is by trading with them. And yeah. So the more you trade with China, the better they get on human rights. And, you know, it goes way back in Iowa history to when Roswell Garst, the seed breeder, invited Nikita Khrushchev to Coon Rapids, Iowa, to talk mm-hmm. about ending the Cold War through food and agriculture.
Right.
And, you know, so... the trade issues, I think, are very important, and that's what I would ask Trump is, you can build relations in the world through food, and you don't use food as a weapon. And,
yes.
So that's what we should be talking about.
Yeah, that's true. But, we know that he doesn't care about that. What about other Republican leaders? I mean, you mentioned Chuck Grassley earlier, and I haven't seen, even though he's from a big ag state, he's not exactly been the best friend to farmers over the last, I don't know how many terms he's had, but you know what I mean? It's like, I don't see that he's so great.
Grassley is a farmer himself, and he does at least make plaintive sounds about the Bayer-Monsanto merger or the mergers in the Packers and Stockyards Act, and how the Trump administration has dismantled the Packer and Stockyard Administration, which was the right. antitrust enforcement mechanism in the meatpacking industry. And so he right. makes sounds about it, but nothing ever changes.
Yeah.
And but Grassley sort of drank the Kool-Aid in 2010 when the Tea Party came out, and then Grassley was telling people that, grandma's going to get cut off Medicare and death panels and all that stuff.
Yes,
and,
I remember.
And he hijacked the health care legislation with Max Baucus, and they took it in a dark room and shot the public option in the head.
Yeah. Art, I'm not laughing because it's funny. I'm laughing because you're funny.
Yeah, well,
that's a beautiful way of putting it.
And, you know, he's right now he's in a lust for power, and he's Mitch McConnell's lap puppy.
Yeah,
and did his work on the Judiciary Committee, and then he'll make sounds again about how the farmers are having a tough time, and we got to do something for them. Where's the flooding disaster aid hung up on Puerto Rico?
Yeah.
Where's Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst's
well,
outrage?
I mean, that's a scandal in and of itself. But I mean, there's the flooding in Iowa. You got clobbered twice, right? Didn't you just have another bomb cyclone last week?
Yeah, in Minnesota and all over. And where are they voting today on disaster aid? No, because they don't want to help Puerto Rico.
Right. Pretty much. That seems to be, brown people. Can't be giving them any money. No, sir.
So you're right. Chuck Grassley is selling farmers down the muddy Missouri.
Yeah, right, right. So, you know, since you live in the, one of the most, if not the most important agricultural state in the union, what do you see are the greatest challenges to local farmers? I mean, is it the tariffs that have, you know, the most recent outrage to farmers? Is it the overwhelming consolidation, or is it more sort of prosaic stuff like, you know, land access or excessive regulation, which is something that a lot of farmers like to complain about? What do you?
It's really all about money. It's really all about markets, and these tariffs need to go away. And I think most Iowans, Iowa has an export sensitive economy. We are involved in agriculture and manufacturing, and that's it. And I think most Iowans agree that free trade, you're going to get a better deal than with tariffs. And I think that that's the immediate problem.
Right.
And then we need to move on to all the other issues like transparency and markets, mm-hmm. and you know, concentration and overproduction by conglomerates that are, by design, driving independent dairy producers out of business. They did it in the hog industry in 1998. Right. They intentionally drove hog prices down to 8 cents. And the farmers were shooting their hogs and burying them in the field, 40 to the acre, rather than turn them over to the market, which was corrupt and being manipulated by these pork integrators.
Yes.
And now there are no independent pork producers left. They too were assassinated in 1998. And that's exactly what they're doing to the dairy industry now.
Yes, it is. Yep. I did quite a long series on that. But I am interested by the pork situation because, you know, there are guys that are still willing to go under the yoke of one of those integrators. You know, I find that fascinating. I guess if you want to raise hogs, you want to raise hogs. And if you don't work with the big integrators, you can't do your job.
Yeah, and it's a steady source of income for young people who can't get into agriculture, but they can put up this building and it'll give them, you know, they can just make a living on it. They know how much, the integrators know how much they can pay to keep a guy, so he'll build another building. But they give you just enough.
Right, just enough and not more. And then if they piss you off, well, too bad. You're not getting another contract. I mean,
right.
It is pretty, it's, I mean, the whole integration, that whole model, I think is so deeply suspect and corrupt that, you know, right there is a major challenge for somebody to clean up that aspect of agriculture. But so to give a little history lesson, what are the biggest changes you've observed in your state over the past few decades? And, you know, what can people hope to see as a lesson from that? Like, is it just about the consolidation, or, you know, where do we start unraveling some of that so-called progress that isn't so progressive?
Yeah, well, I think one of the changes we're seeing that's really hopeful is that despite the fact that, you know, Iowa's state government is essentially owned by the Koch brothers and the seed and chemical companies, farmers themselves are seeking alternatives after losing money 5-6 straight years, and they're looking for ways to reduce chemicals and to reduce seed costs and to make money. And they're finding that outfits like the Practical Farmers of Iowa Sustainable Ag Group, that those guys are all showing up to their field days in new pickups. And the guys that are doing rotational grazing and saving soil and raising locally sourced beef. And those guys are making money. And the guys that are farming 3,000 acres of corn and soybeans are losing their money every year. And so those guys actually are interested in what the Practical Farmers of Iowa are doing, because they're seeing it show up in the profit and loss statements.
Yes.
So I think they're way ahead of the political class. And although it's very small, it's growing at a very rapid pace, and especially around urban areas where local food economies are starting to develop.
Right, right. Yeah, and you can sell into restaurants and institutions more easily.
Right.
So do you have infrastructure in place with these guys? I mean, are they building their own infrastructure? Because, I mean, I know one of the biggest problems for people who want to produce independently, certainly in the animal agriculture sector, is that there's no processing facility available. So is that, are you starting to see investment, capital investment in that kind of infrastructure or, you know, aggregation and production warehouses where people can, you know, create a food hub and farmers can drop off all their stuff and get it packed and sent out?
Right. That will come, but first the cattle need to come back. And there's got to be a way to incent those cattle to come back, and that's when we get back to discussing the Farm Bill again and the Conservation Stewardship Program and allowing people to graze on CRP acres and the like. Uh-huh. And when we get to that conversation, then we can begin to talk about, you know, rejuvenating rural communities with local processing facilities, manned by immigrants if necessary, because nobody else wants to live in North Dakota or South Dakota. So, you know, let's get real.
Yeah, I'm afraid I wouldn't go there. I mean, I like living in the country, but, you know, I can't handle that weather.
And General Mills now, you know, one of the big agribusiness giants is encouraging now regenerative agriculture because consumers are demanding that we don't use BT corn and genetically modified corn and oats in their cornflakes and oatmeal. Mm-hmm. And so now General Mills is asking farmers in North Dakota, and they're investing in these farmers in North Dakota and South Dakota to grow organic or regenerative non-GMO crops for their human food consumption. So there are hopeful signs.
Yeah, right, absolutely. What about pot? Is Iowa anywhere near legalizing pot?
No, I think Iowa will be the last state in the country that legalizes marijuana.
Now, that's too
bad. Right up with Nebraska. And we didn't have liquor by the drink in Iowa until 1965, and it took an alcoholic governor, a recovering alcoholic governor, to do it. Yeah, he was sober when he did it, and he had the moral credibility.
Yeah, right, right. That's hilarious. It's too bad because, you know, Kentucky is going to start growing hemp. Okay, it's not pot. But, I mean, hemp is also another crop that's, like, very hardy, very useful, very versatile, good for the soil, retains carbon.
And it actually is, it has a higher ethanol value than, and it builds soil health. It's got a higher ethanol value than corn.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Iowa used to be, during World War II, in fact, Storm Lake was a major hemp production center for the production of rope on ships and the like.
Right.
And that's why you can't grow good marijuana in Iowa, is because there's too much hemp here.
So when you had Tom Vilsack as the head of the USDA, because he was governor of Iowa before that, right?
Yes, he was.
Yeah, and so then he became the head of the USDA. He stayed 8 years of the Obama administration. Did you feel like he made better farm policy for your constituency, or did you feel that his, you know, tenure was just more business as usual? I mean, for example, he watched the dairy industry go belly up and didn't seem to lift a finger about that. So, what was your sense of him as an advocate for the Iowa farmer?
I think. In terms of advancing the ball on sustainable agriculture and all the things we've been discussing, he was a sort of a caretaker, Secretary of Agriculture. I think he's somewhat of a visionary on building rural communities, and I think that he hasn't received recognition for that.
No kidding. Interesting.
And trying to develop rural housing and all the myriad things that USDA does, we tend to concentrate on the farm program. You know, he did get the Conservation Stewardship Program in place, but it was, you know, it was being fought so hard by the corporate interests. He was in a difficult position, and the USDA, you know, is heavily influenced, you know, by corporate food companies.
Understood.
I should say pressured, not influenced, but pressured constantly. And so he stood up against that, I think. But he, you know, did he advance the ball on sustainable ag and a vision beyond corn ethanol? I'm not sure.
Right. Despite the Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food campaign, it didn't really seem to penetrate the heartland, in my observation. It was, you know, great in sort of urban areas and great on the coasts, I think.
But we certainly didn't go backward as we are under Sonny Perdue, where we're cutting these right. conservation programs and trying to divorce food stamps from the Farm Bill, for example.
Yes.
And Vilsack fought off all that stuff. And so I think he does deserve some credit for that. And because the Obama administration wasn't exactly, he campaigned as a populist and governed as a corporatist. So,
yes, quite a bit. Even though I still love him.
I love him too. Yeah, I do. And for a lot of reasons.
So you're saying, so Sonny Perdue, our current USDA secretary, or secretary of agriculture, excuse me, he doesn't seem to be doing anything that I mean, I don't hear anything about policies that he's advancing.
Nor do I. Well, I guess they did get a new poultry center in Georgia.
So, well, that's great.
Yeah, taking care of the home crowd. Uh-huh, yeah.
But right. Yeah, I mean, aside from that, I'm really not getting the sense that he has a vision for American agriculture or any sense that there is value in addressing, the challenges of climate change. He doesn't seem to be aware that that's happening.
Did you expect one?
I'm sorry?
Did you expect a vision from a Trump agriculture secretary? How could we expect a vision from any of them?
Well, no, I didn't. But in the real world, yes, I would have. But since we dwell in something, you know, some further circle of hell at the moment.
Some other world, yes.
It's not realistic, of course, to expect anything, any kind of policy from any of these clowns, aside from the policy of lining their pockets.
Right. No, but you're right. Sonny Perdue, what has he done? I don't know. We got a farm bill done several months late, and it's lame. And it undermines the most important programs in the farm bill. So no, he has no accomplishment that I could cite. And again, I'm asking, where's the money, Sonny? We have these floods and there's no money. Where is the Trump administration in forwarding the disaster money to the Midwest?
That's right. That's right. Because I mean, really, I don't know if people are aware of the fact, but most crops should normally be getting planted right around now. Am I right? I mean, isn't it sort of the last couple weeks of April, beginning of May, that you start putting your crops in?
Yeah, within the next week or two. And there's still farmers trying to negotiate loans.
Yeah. So that's pretty alarming if they're not going to be able to do that. And then I was asking Chris Jones, again, I'm going to all go off on a little tangent here, but then I'm going to reel it back and we'll talk about your book. One of the things that I was asking Chris Jones is how much does the flooding affect the soil composition of these fields? Like, you know, does it make it harder, worse? Will the stuff not grow? I mean, like, what are the implications of the flooding? Once the waters recede, what are people supposed to do? They've got a field full of mud. I don't know how you plant a crop in that.
Right. Actually, I was just heard the state climatologist say that there's tens of thousands of acres in southwest Iowa that were flooded out and again scoured down to sand that won't be able to support vegetative life for 10 years. These were cornfields.
And, oh, my gosh.
We're losing soil 4 to 10 times faster than we can regenerate soil in Iowa. And it's a relatively flat state, as we all know.
Right.
And so it's not like it's running down the hills. It is, it's just wind and water are driving it in sheets to the Mississippi River, where it's dumping into the Gulf of Mexico and creating this huge dead zone.
Right.
Yes, it is depleting soil and to the point where, and this is happening worldwide, where Chinese wheat production now is falling 5% a year because of soil degradation. Think about that.
Wow. I'm thinking. I'm thinking these are big numbers. You're going to come back and we're going to talk about soil and water pollution. Because I'd love to, actually, if you could send me all of the articles that you wrote about that so I can have a good long read up, I'd be grateful to you. But let's take this moment now to promote you shamelessly. Talk about your book, because it just basically came out not even a year ago, right?
Last October,
you know, tell people what to expect from reading it and where they can get it and how they can learn more.
Yeah, it's called Storm Lake, A Chronicle of Change, Resilience, and Hope from a Heartland Newspaper, and it's published by Viking, which is an imprint of Penguin Random House. Mm-hmm. And you can order it from all the online bookstores, but I prefer that you order it from an independent bookstore if you have one nearby, if there's one left. it's about I call it a cultural history wrapped in a memoir about how, you know, a small town newspaper guy won a Pulitzer Prize talking about agriculture and the environment and immigration and how it's all connected. And so I tell stories about my youth in Storm Lake, about the history of the glaciers, about how we drove indigenous people off the land, broke the land, and began its destruction with the plow, and how it takes us to today, to this highly integrated extractive system that mines the soil and replaces it with petrochemicals. And then how we flush it all down our river systems every spring and fall. But how we know the solution, and it again starts with the indigenous people that we found here in the first place, who moved with the landscape and who lived on the landscape and of it and didn't seek to dominate it. And that there's a lot of lessons there for us. We know how to do it. We know how to survive and be resilient if we choose to be. And that's really what the thrust of the book is, that rural communities can be resilient if they welcome new people and new ways of thinking and new ways of growing food. And that we can reverse this decades-long decline of rural depopulation, and we can turn it around into communities like Storm Lake that are now building themselves organically through families who want to be together.
Uh-huh. Sounds great. Art, I'm going to order a copy, and I'm going to send you a copy of my book. How about that?
Excellent. What's the name of it? Give yourself a plug.
My book is called What's the Matter with Meat? And it also published in 2017, and it's an examination of the global animal agricultural industry, and I target five major production centers, including obviously the United States, Brazil, the EU, China, and I forget what the other one is. Oh, Australia, obviously. I'll send you a copy. I think you'll find it quite interesting. It's written
Thank
like
you.
A long press release. I'm not a great writer, but I definitely knew my facts. Can't remember now, but I knew them then. Anyway, Art, thank you very much for this. Send me that series on water pollution, and we'll pick this up in a few weeks and talk again about that series. Art, thank you so much for joining me today. Thanks to my sponsor and to my excellent engineer, Matt. We'll see you next week, folks. We'll talk more about what's going on in our agricultural communities and our food industry as we go forward through this year. Thanks for listening. Until next time. Bye-bye for now.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like. Tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.